Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of the Redox Podcast. I wanted to chime in with a quick plug to let you know that what you're about to get into is also available in video form. Yes, that's right. You can see me, my guest Terrence Hibbert, a few slides even, and video snippets from all of our guests answering the question, what will be the lasting impact of the pandemic on digital health? So if you'd rather watch us, head on over to redoxengine.com/quarterly to access this special episode, along with other videos from our Q4 quarterly event entitled Grow Through Change. You'll be able to check out an excellent keynote from my co-founder and Redox CEO, Luke Bonney, as well as customer highlights, product advancements, what we're doing with Fire, and tips to grow in the digital health space based on our experience connecting vendors to more than 1,000 health systems. If any of this is interesting, again, check out redoxengine.com/quarterly to access all of that. But if you're really just into the audio today, that's cool. Let's get into the show. Welcome to the Redox Podcast, where we explore the intersection of healthcare and technology with some of our industry's most notable contributors. I'm your host, Nico Skivaski. In my day job, I'm the co-founder and president of Redox, where we're on a mission to enable the frictionless adoption of technology in healthcare. We started the show to share what we're learning and hopefully allow you to skip some steps as you embark on your journey through making healthcare a little bit better. So without further ado, I welcome you to the Redox Podcast. We started doing these shows back in November of 2019. That was back before the world changed. Then, of course, in March, we got hit with a pandemic, and that really made everything we were talking about up until that point moot. The world is going through massive change, especially in healthcare. So on today's show, we're going to dive into some of those changes. I invited some of our early guests on the podcast to make a quick video answering the question, what will be the lasting impact of the pandemic on healthcare? We'll hear from Dr. Bill Hansen, CMIO of UPenn, Jonathan Bush, Executive Chairman of Firefly, and of course, the founder of Athena Health. We'll hear from Stephanie Telenius, who's the CEO at Vita, and Aaron Patzer, the CEO of Vital, and many, many others. There are certainly themes that carry throughout, but there are also different messages that I think are worth discussing and delving into. So to help with all that delving, I invited my old friend, Terrence Hibbert, to hang out with me and talk through some of these predictions. Terrence was most recently the Director of Innovation at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And prior to that, he was the Director of IT Solutions at UMC. Terrence, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nico. Great to be here.
Yeah, I am super excited to dive into this with you. But first off, how is quarantine life going in Idaho?
Not bad. Idaho's third wave is hitting pretty hard. The governor on Monday announced that they're going from stage four back to stage three, which doesn't have huge impacts, but certainly psychologically, it's sending a message that, you know, things aren't good and aren't getting better. So,
yeah. And I think that's kind of exemplary of what we're seeing around the world, right? I heard that Italy, that did such a good job, you know, displaying to the world what quarantining can do and how that can help quell a spike. They're actually protesting against the new stay-at-home measures there. So yeah, we're definitely hitting something again. And that, I think it kind of goes to show how long this during COVID era will be. So I've been liking to talk about our situation in sort of three eras: BC before COVID, DC during COVID, and of course after COVID, which will hopefully sometime occur.
Let's be positive and suggest that one day there will be an after COVID.
Yeah, certainly. You know, DC hit us really hard, really quickly in March. I think we were all surprised by how quickly COVID spread, how impactful the stay-at-home measures were, and what quarantine really has done to us and how long that has lasted. Like we were just talking about, we're seeing regional flare-ups around the country. It's kind of interesting seeing these flare-ups happen outside of the cities where we saw sort of the initial epicenter for a lot of this. Of course, testing and subsequent contact tracing has developed dramatically over the past months. So that's been kind of new technologies that were developed, new distribution methods of those technologies. And then hopefully someday, one day in the future, a vaccine will be created, approved, and distributed. A lot of question these days about the efficacy of what a vaccine will bring, as well as, you know, how we're actually going to distribute that. So, you know, I just like to this framework for talking about this as we kind of go into some of these predictions that these founders and other healthcare experts are going to make.
Yeah, I think it's a great one. Some of that, the improvement that isn't kind of represented here also has to do with how physicians are better able to care for people who actually get COVID and the impact that that's having. But certainly, you know, I love the BCDCAC. It's fantastic.
Taking back the acronyms from Christ.
Yeah. Or AC/DC, the band, whichever you want to.
So as a quick review, we asked all of these folks, what will be the lasting effect of the pandemic on healthcare technology? So we'll get some hot takes and excited to chat about them with you. So first up, we have Dr. Bill Hansen, CMIO at University of Pennsylvania. Let's hear what he has to say.
In the early stages of the pandemic, telemedicine went from a want-to-have to a must-have for most major healthcare organizations. And many vendors saw massive increases in their demand. Telemedicine, in a sense, takes us back to the time when much of the care was provided in the home by doctors who traveled to the patients. We've moved to a time when patients must come to the hospital for their care, and telemedicine has shown us that there is value in using technology to bridge the gap between the hospital or clinic setting and the patient's home. We're also seeing increases in the acceptability and usefulness of remote patient monitoring. These are the lasting impacts of the pandemic on medical care.
Okay, so I wanted to start with that one because I think that Dr. Hansen just hit the nail on the head with the adoption of telehealth, right? That's mm-hmm. the kind of big elephant in the room. Everyone talks about it's dramatically increasing numbers. You know, you played a big part in telehealth at University of Mississippi, like in that BC era, mm-hmm. and the challenges of getting people to adopt it. What do you think were the big changes that happened during the pandemic that forced the adoption and really turned it into the necessity that Bill was talking about?
Yeah, at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, it was one of two national centers of excellence for telemedicine. And what that was really a big federal grant that allowed us to kind of explore what the bounds are of telemedicine and the efficacy and start to think about what the rules of engagement should be. So it's not quite as much of a free-for-all. And then, you know, COVID comes along and, you know, they're telling people not to leave their homes, including people who have pre-existing conditions and long-term chronic illnesses and that sort of thing. B, the people are afraid to leave their homes. They just don't want to. The last place they want to go is to a medical facility. You know, they'll go to the grocery store, but they don't want to go to a place where other sick people are because of an enhanced fear of something bad happening. And so I think that combination, you know, just forced everybody's hand that they, you know, even small practitioners had to adopt telemedicine where they had no intention of doing so before, but they couldn't see their patients otherwise.
Yeah, really created that necessity. But before the pandemic, how were you thinking about telemedicine? Was it kind of like a nice to have or sort of a feature that, you know, your digital native patients would use? Like how did that mentality change? And what was it like in that before COVID period?
Yeah, I think it was considered, a lot of people just kept considering it the future, kind of perpetually, a perpetual thing where it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. But it was never happening. Like that catalyst wasn't really, really there. And so the clinicians that I had talked to that had experimented with it and that were doing it were seeing certain advantages. I had heard that, you know, other people, Mississippi was fortunate in that they legislated years ago that telehealth payments would be paid the same as in-person payments and really sort of paved the way for us to kind of go forward. But so the landscape was there, but clinicians and patients weren't necessarily adopting it. A lot of patients still felt like they needed to go and see their doctor and rightly so. I mean, it's hard to just have a video conversation about your health if the doctor can't touch you or you know, feel a heartbeat or you know, look into your eye and that sort of thing. And so those barriers were there and no one was really pushing those through. And, you know, there were experiments that were showing really good results. There was one that was done with remote patient monitoring on diabetes patients. And one of the metrics they used was how many visits to the ER the patients in the test group had. And I can't remember what they had before the study started. This in the 6 months before the study started, but in the 6 month period of the study, they had zero. Like people just They understood more about what was happening with their diabetes. They understood more about diabetes as a disease and how to live life with it and all of those things. And so it was having a huge impact, but then I remember when that study came out, I was like, okay, this is it, right? Yeah. Now we're going to get somewhere. Now we're talking about diabetes. It's a huge cost in the medical system. It was way cheaper. You know, it showed all kinds of great stuff and just nothing happened. And so I think that was life in BC.
Yeah. Well, and you know, like you were saying, the technology was there. There had been studies that showed mm-hmm. to be effective, but it seems like the real change was in the behavior of both providers and patients in yeah. being okay with hopping on video. Just like, you know, we're on a Zoom right now. People are used to it. This is how our lives work.
Yeah, and I think people are starting to understand the convenience of not having to waste 4 hours of your day going to a doctor's office, sitting in a room, and then, you know, when all you have the flu and you just need a prescription and you just need to get back on your life. If you can do that in 15 minutes versus 3 hours, mm-hmm. it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that Dr. Hansen talked about was hearkening back to the era where providers actually came to people's homes and mm-hmm. saw what their living environment was like, mm-hmm. you know, potentially met their pets and their mm-hmm. and their family, which is all much more accessible through video now. So making it much more convenient for patients. But that kind of brings up another topic where I want to get to our next video here with Andrew Richards, because I think he kind of highlights some of the shortcomings of telehealth as well. So Andrew Richards, of course, is one of the probably best known for being part of the Pink Socks movement. So if you've ever been to a health tech conference, you've probably been taking care of
Pink Socks. I have Pink Socks.
Yeah, of course. He has them displayed there in the corner. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
But he's also working on a project called Amend Health right now, which is focused on rural communities, rural hospitals, rural clinics, FQHCs, and the like. And of course, kind of points out some of the challenges with telehealth in those areas.
Due to the COVID pandemic, we have seen major changes in how care is delivered, specifically through telemedicine. Of course, this has exposed many challenges around reimbursement, especially for Medicare and Medicaid patients. What happens next remains to be seen, though this really needs to be addressed quickly. Beyond limited reimbursement, we're also seeing weakness around broadband and connectivity in many of our rural and underserved communities. How that gets addressed also remains to be seen. Promising technologies like Starlink, which recently deployed here in Washington State for several new pilot projects, seems to be an interesting alternative to traditionally running fiber to some of these communities. Connectivity is key. Reimbursement is key to support this new healthcare delivery paradigm that we're suddenly living in, which we've spent so many years trying to achieve. Things are happening fast. Let's see what happens next.
Nice. I love yeah. that positivity, right?
It was very polished. It was very polished.
Well, I think he brings up really great points where telemedicine can fall short, right? The problems mm-hmm. that still need to be addressed, like connectivity, especially in rural environments. Mississippi, of course, has a lot of rural communities.
So does Idaho, where I am now. Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you were doing even in the before COVID period to try to help address that?
Yeah, that's one of those areas where healthcare providers feel very limited, right? Like if you don't have internet in your house, we feel like, well, you know, it's a non-starter for us. But what a lot of organizations were doing, and partially it had to do with the way telemedicine was being reimbursed in Mississippi, was they were creating community centers where people could go to. So they don't have to drive 3-4 hours to a hospital, let alone, you know, to an academic medical center like us, but they could go there to somewhere that's 5 minutes away and have a telehealth visit, have a nurse's aide or someone like that kind of there taking vitals and doing some of those things so that the clinician that the patient is speaking to can actually get some of that data mm-hmm. and be able to actually have a productive visit. It was actually a requirement of, what did they call them, sites of service, where you had to be a registered site of service to be able to deliver telehealth. It wasn't just people in their homes. And there's an advantage to that, and there are obviously disadvantages to that, but it solved a lot of the connectivity issue because you just had to provide connectivity to that one community center. You didn't have to provide it to everybody's individual houses, but it's still limited. Some people, you know, didn't have cars. There's no public transit out there. So it was still a little limited and a little difficult to do. So it's definitely an issue that you're seeing.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, on the transportation front, we're going to hear from Ankit later on in the show, who's the co-founder of Roundtrip, which is creating that platform for transportation. One thing that Andrew mentioned that I thought was interesting, I had to look it up, was he was talking about Starlink, which is actually a SpaceX project to launch an internet satellite that can provide Wi-Fi for all sorts of rural communities anywhere in the world. So certainly a future facing solution to this problem, but something that, you know, could be a potential interesting case study to look at as that unfolds in Washington there.
Yeah, and I think that I wonder what some of our local, our national cell service providers, what they're going to do with their 4G equipment when they get rid of it and substitute it for 5G equipment. You know, it seems to me like you've already got this stuff, might as well deploy it in areas that you didn't have it before, and maybe that could provide some connectivity as well.
Yeah, certainly.
But I haven't heard of anybody doing that yet.
Yeah, that's a really interesting kind of approach to it, for sure. It'll be interesting to see how that future unfolds.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that helped with telehealth adoption was some policy that the government put forth. You know, we talked about parity with reimbursements for telehealth visits, especially in the Medicare populations. But another regulatory push was on the HIPAA front. And so this video from Matt Fisher talks about it a little bit. He is the chair of health law at Merrick and O'Connell law firm. And I like talking to Matt because he kind of makes health law not so boring. So let's hear what he has to say.
This is Matt Fisher, the chair of the health law group at Myrick O'Connell, a law firm in central Massachusetts. The impact of the pandemic on healthcare technology will be to demonstrate that it can actually be quickly and widely adopted in a beneficial manner. At the same time, it's also going to be necessary to ensure that privacy of information is protected. The pandemic allowed quick adoption of any form of technology with the broad enforcement discretion exercised with regard to HIPAA, but that kind of created a bit of a dangerous situation because non-compliant services were then built into the workflow. It'll be necessary to change that going forward to ensure that patient privacy is fully respected and that appropriate tools are utilized. There are certainly a lot of those available on the market, and it should be relatively easy to be able to put those into place, and hopefully that will occur quickly. At the end of the day, though, as already said, the pandemic fully showed that healthcare technology is something that can provide a lot of benefit in both extending and promoting the overall quality of care. This provides a very optimistic viewpoint and one that should be able to give a lot of comfort going forward.
You know, a lot of people talk about healthcare or digital health as riddled with these barriers to adoption, right? You have to get through all of these governance committees at the health system about where they're sharing data, why they're sharing that data, is the solution secure enough, what sort of data is going into that solution, which adds months and months, if not years, to the actual adoption of technology. And we saw all of that, you know, all of those barriers kind of disappear very quickly as telehealth became essential. What was your experience kind of working in that world? You know, I know you lived with a lot of those barriers and just seeing them all blown away very quickly in March.
Well, yeah, and I have an interesting perspective because I spent several years working in IT before I moved to innovation in the healthcare setting. And I think he's right, but the focus of HIPAA until, you know, we had the regulation come out in March was so focused on protecting the information and not focused at all on sharing the information, which is part of the HIPAA acronym, right? So I think that we can debate what, you know, how good the legislation was or whatever, but the intent of it, that of the legislation that came out in March was to really focus more on sharing. And I think that you know, that is a limiting factor. Like I've seen startups who, you know, are really, they feel like they have to reinvent the wheel in terms of getting and gathering their own data because they can't, you know, there's just this big wall in front of them in terms of historical data on the patients. And it can be quite a problem, especially for anybody who's trying to do anything longitudinally. I think that's a huge issue and a huge barrier. So I think that what Matt was saying was absolutely correct.
So one of the other areas that I think this brings up is just the much wider debate that society is having right now around how companies can use personal and private data to deliver their products and services. And, you know, that goes well beyond healthcare, right? In 2019, mm-hmm. we saw all of big tech kind of getting in the spotlight around it. We mm-hmm. also started seeing healthcare companies or, you know, big tech like Google and Amazon moving into healthcare, starting to look at a lot of this data. And that was kind of becoming normal in the limelight to see these companies poked and prodded and, you know, questions of if that data should be used for things like advertisers or for pharmaceutical companies, or even for other providers doing research, trying to figure out how to actually improve healthcare. One of my predictions in 2019 was that 2020 was going to be the year that debate shakes out. And we actually learn kind of what are the unwritten rules of the internet as far as data goes. But of course, all of that's been placed to the side, but it's still with us, right? I don't know if you saw the film, The Social Dilemma, but I watched that the other night and it scared the crap out of me. But yeah, I think that's another big point here is that, you know, there's a ton of healthcare data that is being collected right now. It's not necessarily being used to its fullest, but what does using that healthcare data actually mean? That's something that we're going to kind of figure out in the years to come AI gets their hands on it.
Well, and one of the things that doctors would never say in public, but they'll tell you privately, is that they're already so busy that they just don't have the ability to absorb this information when they're interacting with a patient, because they only have a few minutes, let alone, you know, 0 minutes to prep to see a patient and that sort of thing. So a lot of them are just kind of resisting using some of this data, even when they have it. And so, you know, like Andrew was saying in the video before, was we have yet to see where this is going to go. And I think that one of the key pieces is facilitating the clinician's ability to work with the data that is being collected. You know, sharing it is super, super important, sharing it across, but then having intelligence, and that's where, you know, I look at a lot of startups that are trying to use AI to clean up the data and to make it much more easily decipherable, and also possibly to even, sorry, not possibly, but definitely to take action on the data on the clinician's behalf by doing things like saying, hey, patient, you know, your A1C is spiking, you need to go and see your doctor now. Like we don't need to wait for, you know, this idea of scheduling things 3 months from now, 4 months from now, 6 months from now. That's what we did when we didn't have data. But what now that we have data, we can totally change the paradigm. But we have to make it easier on the doctors, not give them, oh, look at this great new information that you can spend several minutes trying to understand and absorb and then interpret and then do some, and, you know, and then be prescriptive with your patient. It's got to do a lot of that work for them.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. At Redox, we talk a lot about kind of how data is turned into information. And if you think about software in general, you have the data layer, which is like the database where the software is kept, the data transport layer on top of that, which is where Redox comes in, and other sorts of technologies to help make that data available, to the application layer, which is kind of that top layer. Users use applications. And from my perspective, the whole point of an application, the definition of an application, is something that takes data and turns it into information. Information that can be used by a patient to figure out how to adjust their behavior, like your example with your A1C spiking, right? What can we do to take in data that's kind of rippling underneath and call out what's important there? Which really brings us to this next video with Jonathan Bush. You know, obviously he has a legacy in healthcare technology with Athena Health, which was that application layer that helped providers in the outpatient setting from an EHR perspective. But his new project at Firefly is actually going a step beyond that, and instead of providing technology to brick and mortar clinics, they actually created a new clinic providing direct primary care in a virtual fashion, both synchronously and asynchronously through the use of technology. So I think he has an interesting perspective. He's a little quiet, so I kind of have to lean in, but let's hear what he has to say.
I think the greatest impact of the pandemic on healthcare IT will be the breaking the back of the brick. All of the tech had been focused on offices, hospitals, buildings, a small and declining number of very complicated, troubled buyers. Once the brick and mortar is not the only door into the healthcare system, you have a vastly more open and variant set of buyers for technology, selling mostly virtual, often asynchronous approaches to treatment. And with all the social determinants, all the behaviorally driven care that, you know, in our pie chart, that's actually better. And I think it's also a much better playground for technologists.
So Jonathan just had a baby. So I wonder if he's whispering because he's got a little one sleeping there.
I have been guilty of the same. The last thing you ever want to do is wake the baby.
Exactly. But I think he brings up a really great point in that it is, we talk about technology adoption in healthcare taking, you know, 2 years to go from knowing that you need a solution to actually adopting it. And that that long sales cycle into a health system is fraught with barriers in that everyone, you have to convince 100 people at the health system to say yes, and any one of them can say no, and really create a barrier for that technology to being adopted. So it's almost like Jonathan is suggesting that digital health is going elsewhere to bring that technology to the market. For example, like with Firefly starting their own clinic in a tech-forward manner. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can tell you that when Haven was announced, that scared the living crap out of so many clinicians that it could change. And, you know, who, it doesn't matter who it is. I think Haven just had all the publicity and the intentions around it. But, yeah, you know,
give us a quick rundown on what Haven was supposed to be when it was announced.
Sure. It was very vague, but it, you know, that vagueness can be part of it. It's, you know, it's all of it's, you know, when you add up all the employees of who are the three, it was Amazon,
Morgan,
JP Morgan, and
Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah. You know, they have tons of money, many employees that they could then, you know, they could focus on just providing healthcare to their own employees and then create services out of that and roll it out. And people were very worried that they were just going to supplant all these, you know, so much of the established healthcare out there and create their own digital clinics and all that sort of stuff. And that's why I'm very interested in Firefly. I've been trying to follow them for a little while because I do believe that it is possible to leapfrog the current established players in the healthcare space and do all kinds of new things. I think that certainly the way we treat chronic illness needs to be very much changed. You know, acute illnesses, not so much, you know, surgeries, not so much, but even surgeries, actually dealing with pre-surgery and post-surgery and all those. So there's different elements within it. But yeah, I think that there is a possibility for new companies to come along and just take it a huge step forward. Even the conversation we were just having about effectively using data, you know, if you're a Firefly and you're able to give your customers a wearable, and you actually use that data from the wearable to actually help make decisions and help monitor your patients, it's a night and day difference. That alone is a night and day difference from what happens now. And so it could lead to a revolution.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and I think we're seeing a lot of the care delivery model innovation happening on the outpatient side, right? Groups like Firefly or Iora, mm-hmm. Or One Medical, even with kind of a concierge model happening. But what I find really interesting, you know, One Medical has been doing this for a while. They're a customer of ours. And where we've been helping them is in actually sharing data from their clinics and their approach to healthcare with their large, you know, large regional health systems mm-hmm. that they partner with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, on the outpatient side, they're going to have to refer in for specialty, for acute care, for any surgeries or those sorts of procedures that just can't happen from a primary care setting. So there's still going to be a place for those large health systems, but mm-hmm. I think the fabric of kind of how consumers approach healthcare is going to be changing dramatically. But, you know, Lygia from Carium is our next video here. She talks a lot about how consumers are playing a bigger part in mm-hmm. figuring out kind of how healthcare is going to be delivered. So let's give her a look here and check out her video.
Because of the pandemic, consumers have changing ideas about the role of technology relative to their health. So whether it's virtual visits with clinicians or remote patient monitoring using devices and wearables or connecting with peers online through social groups, consumers are going to be increasingly looking for ways to use technology to make their lives easier and their health better.
Man, I don't know what if that was her house or if that was an office. That was a pretty funky looking space. I like that.
Yeah. It's, I think what you just said was so 2020. Like we're all exploring each other's backgrounds now, right?
Exactly. That's why I've got the Halloween and the kids artwork.
Yep.
If it's actually my artwork, I'm just attributing it to him. But yeah, I think that, you know, and as I become a fan of the Redox podcast, as well as Redox the company, which I've always been a fan of, that I really think that there is going to be a generational change, and not just a generational change in patients, but a generational shift in doctors. You know, some of my favorite people to talk to when I was at UMMC from an innovation standpoint were the interns and these recently minted doctors, because they grew up digital. They are now seeing from the inside just how crazily, I won't say inefficient, but how crazily non-digital health is, and how there are so many things that could happen to improve healthcare. They, as they get older, if it doesn't get beaten out of them by some of the older doctors that are mentoring them, they're going to be a huge force and catalyst for change from the inside to match that sort of consumer demand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, we've been talking about this consumerism trend for a long time. Do you think that the pandemic has accelerated that, or how has it changed how consumers are thinking about their healthcare?
It's a good question. I haven't seen any research on that yet, and I'm sure the research is yet to be created, but certainly, you know, there's nothing like trying it. And I've talked to several people who have tried it, and they were very apprehensive beforehand. And afterwards, they were like, actually, that was great. You know, not only did I not have to leave my house and go and waste a whole bunch of time, but I got what I actually needed. I have spoken to one or two people, though, who have said, like, the experience just wasn't the same. They didn't feel like they could communicate with their doctor effectively. They wanted their doctor to be able to feel this lump or something like that, and the doctor can't do that. So obviously, that's another thing I'm really anxious to hear data about, is the limitations of it. I think it's a great thing and it's a wonderful thing, but it's not a panacea, and it won't solve all the problems. And so creating, there is going to need to be a bit of a box put around it so that patients don't think it can solve all their problems. I really, you know, the question about patient outcomes is a serious one. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I just read a study. It was early in the pandemic that PwC put out a survey, and of the people who had their first telehealth visit ever during the pandemic, mm-hmm. 88% of them said that they would like to do it again. So kind of what you were talking about, how I think a lot of people were nervous about doing it the first time, but once they do it, they realize, hey, this actually works. This can work for me and provide the benefits that we're looking for.
Especially for follow-up visits, it's wonderful.
Certainly, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to turn to Aaron Patzer, who is our next video. Aaron was famously the founder of Mint.com, which I think was the technology that really kind of started the financial technology, the fintech mm-hmm. revolution, and bringing kind of financial information to our fingertips as consumers. So I love talking to him about healthcare. He, of course, has founded Vital, which is a technology used in the emergency department for both providers and patients. And I find it really interesting, his perspectives kind of coming from that consumer world, knowing what it's like to change an industry, and then attempting to do so on the healthcare side as well. So let's mm-hmm. hear from Aaron.
Post-pandemic, I think we're going to see more real-time interoperability between hospitals statewide and nationally. Back in March, we saw Georgia's reported COVID cases were well behind what we were seeing live in the emergency department. And I think a big part of that discrepancy is due to the manual data gathering and lack of data interoperability. I think that's going to start changing. Beyond using Redox, I expect HIEs to roll up regionally, national public programs like Care Quality to start to gain in momentum, and national private network effect type companies like CMT, Patient Ping, or Audacious Inquiry to become critical data markets. And then hopefully the public systems start to tie into all of these data feeds to better inform the public.
I feel, you know, that in terms of things that are going to limit consumerism, I don't think there's anything as big as interoperability and the data sharing. And I think in one of your previous podcasts, you were talking about kind of the three layers of that. And the third layer was the, you know, the consumer initiated or the patient initiated sort of passing of data from clinician to clinician. And I think that is what I think that consumers need to be jumping up and down and shouting for. Yeah. Is the ability to be able to access their own information and share it with somebody else at their own prerogative, right? And you know, HIPAA allows for it. When you read the information, HIPAA totally allows for it, but so many people have kind of interpreted HIPAA as something that just says, oh no, we can't let it go. We have to know where it's going, or you know, we have to give authority to share the data versus it being actually owned by the patient. And I think that is, you know, it's not a technology problem. Redox has that covered. It's a human, yeah, exactly. You can pat yourself on the back on that one. But it's a human issue. Like it's something that we need to be able to solve because as you said, like the benefits of being able to aggregate all this data on a statewide or national level is humongous. Like it is absolutely crazy. Imagine if we could really even get information on something as simple as allergies, you know, when people's allergies are flaring up and what's happening, and then coordinate that with the weather data that we already have access to on a national basis, the amount of information that could be derived from that, and then the solutions that could be used to help these allergy sufferers would like, it would just leap forward if we had access to all the data, but that's what's holding it back.
Yeah, absolutely. That, and that example reminds me of one of our customers, Propeller Health, who puts a sensor on top of an inhaler. So when a patient is having an asthma attack, they hit their inhaler, automatically sends a signal to Propeller saying the patient is using their inhaler, this is their location. And they can tie that into all of the socioeconomic and sort of data around, like geographic data and climate data around what's going on with that patient to determine, you know, what's actually the cause of it. And looking across their entire, you know, millions of patients across the country can make some really impactful changes. But yeah, going back to a point you were making about interoperability being this barrier or potentially enabler of consumerism, I think is huge. It's kind of this underlying missing piece of infrastructure that if it was available, if every patient had the ability to pull down their medical records and use whatever app they wanted, then we might see a more consumer-driven approach to healthcare, where they can act more like consumers in the sense of their shopping. They can go to providers that make sense for them, that are convenient for them. And those providers can work together really, really in a decentralized fashion with the patient sharing that data with those that they want. So it kind of goes against the paternalistic nature of traditional medicine. But when a consumer is actually driving their cost-benefit decisions, that's when markets are most efficient. And so, if we're looking at the efficiency of an industry, I think that's a really exciting place to be. And you know, of course, we have new regulations right now that are pushing the industry in that direction. Some of the rules coming out of the 21st Century Cures Act, the information blocking rules, the data sharing rules using Spread on Fire that are coming out, are all pushing us in that direction. And so, that's, for me, that's a future that, like, you know, even just having this conversation, I'm getting goosebumps right now, you know, that I really want to happen.
Yeah.
So hopefully.
And it has to, it absolutely has to happen. If we're going to have a future where patients can control their own health. And, you know, some patients don't want to, you meet people who just want to do what the doctor tells them, but you have a whole generation of people who will say, you know, that's not good enough. I need a team of doctors, for example, who can help me with various illnesses. You know, my wife has chronic undiagnosed illnesses that, you know, we've been to all kinds of doctors and specialists and unfortunately quite a few quacks that, you know, that think that they have it, but they all want to gather their own data and their own information. They want to run tests again that were run 3 months ago. And that, you know, and it, you know, which is why I wonder why the payers aren't screaming for this sort of thing as well, is that it costs them money, but it's got to happen. It is the key enabler that needs to happen to make all of this consumerism stuff happen.
Yeah. Well, and payers might actually have the right incentives, right? They don't necessarily care if you're getting care within the same healthcare organization. What matters to them is that you're getting effective care at a low cost. And that's a perfect segue. Thanks for doing that. To our next clip here. I actually don't have video for this one. I just have audio. So this is okay. Stephanie Telenius from Vita, and they have a chronic care and mental health solution that they actually sell to payers and employers who take risk on their own employees. And she brings up a topic that we haven't touched here yet that I think is going to be really important.
There's just an increase in stress, depression, anxiety across the workforce. People, you know, having their loved ones getting sick or worried about the economic implications of COVID, or, you know, managing their kids on Zoom at home and trying to give them a great education at the same time that they're not really able to go to school. So there's just a lot of stress, and you're seeing burnout a bit too, because people are working longer hours. I think people are feeling pretty productive at home, but they're also dealing with their whole family and the stress of managing that. What I find most fascinating is when we work with large payers, we get claims data so we can tell who's been coded for depression or anxiety. And we take in those files. They're typically in the population, you'll see sort of one in five that have anxiety or depression. And so it's generally between 17 and 20%. When we did the PHQ and GAD surveys this time after COVID, we ended up seeing about 45 to 60% of the population that qualified for mental health needs and services. So it's a big jump. And I think people who are living with chronic disease and have co-occurring depression and anxiety just makes it even harder.
Yeah, we're going to need a whole other podcast to sit down and talk about what's happening in mental health. It is ripe for and really necessary for a complete change and a revolution. And we need to stop waiting, you know, if we need to stop waiting for people to have acute mental health issues and focus more on having people preserve it. You know, what I've seen even at UMMC is providing telemental health in schools and physician to physician consults for rural practitioners who are, you know, they're just the family doctor and people go to them for all kinds of things that they haven't been trained for. So being able to provide for them to be able to call a professional psychiatrist or psychologist and get a proper consult is hugely important when it comes to that sort of rural health sort of stuff. And I think that's where, you know, and then the data at which point the data interoperability is critical in terms of sharing that information. So I think that she's spot on, and it's the coming aftershock, yeah, you know, in an AC world.
Yeah. And one of the things that I talked to Stephanie about was, there's a couple things that she kept bringing up, the fact that chronic condition and mental health are really tied together. There's a huge overlap there, and that's why it makes so much sense for them to treat both. But there are also things that you really have to attack early on. Like once you are in a hospital, it's far too late for those mm-hmm. things, which is where I think payers come in. So Vita does not sell to health systems. They work with payers and with employers. Mm-hmm. And I feel like during the pandemic, right, health systems took a huge financial hit. Mm-hmm. Payers, on the other hand, are sitting on a ton of cash because they're not having to pay out claims. And so I mm-hmm. almost feel like the nexus of power in digital health is almost shifting to payers as they try to figure out how can we invest this cash into treating our patients, into keeping them out of the hospital setting. And basically, you know, coming at value-based care from the payer angle. You know, we talk a lot about providers taking on risk, but I think payers mm-hmm. are taking on healthcare and coming mm-hmm. at it from that side too. And Vita is a great example of that.
Well, you know, and I think you're an economist, so you understand that like one of the biggest issues in healthcare is that the incentives aren't aligned between the different mm-hmm. parties. In many ways, the patient isn't the customer, right? It's the payer that's the customer. And that's why a lot of patients don't shop for their healthcare, because they don't have the right incentives. And that's why a lot of doctors do all kinds of tests that maybe may or may not be necessary, because they don't have the right incentives. And a lot of payers don't have the right incentives either. Yep. You know, to really focus on, as you so eloquently put it, providing effective healthcare at a reasonable cost. It's not in very many people's best interest right now. And that's a big issue.
I think one of the lasting impacts to the COVID-19 pandemic as it relates to the healthcare industry is the increasing adoption of digital transformation, especially in the telehealth space and others, that will continue to propel digital health forward.
You know, in an AC world, hopefully the DC was the catalyst for propelling some of this stuff forward. People are seeing what's possible, and, you know, there are still going to be barriers. The barriers haven't really changed that much, but mm-hmm. but I think there's going to be more desire to break down those barriers.
certainly. Yeah, the AC, the after COVID world, will not look like the BC world in a lot of good ways, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Nico. Thanks for inviting me. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome. Yeah, have a good one. We'll see you later on.
Take care.
Well, there you have it, the 31st episode of the Redox podcast. Thank you so much to Terrence and all the contributors today. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're interested in watching the video version of this show, check out redoxengine.com/quarterly to find that, as well as other great videos that are part of our quarterly event that we put on every quarter. This one is focused on wrapping up 2020. What a year it's been. So check that out, redoxengine.com/quarterly. And until next time, thanks for listening to the Redox podcast.